This episode is brought to you by Neon presenting La Chimera. In Alice Rohrwacher's latest film, a wandering tomb raider navigates the blurred lines between past and present in rural Italy, haunted by a lost love and the allure of ancient treasures.
Hello, Next Picture Show listeners. Here's a friendly reminder that if you enjoy the Next Picture Show, you'll really enjoy getting more Next Picture Show by subscribing to our Patreon. You can unlock ad-free versions of the podcast for $3 a month and get bonus episodes on current TV, movies we don't cover on the podcast, and other topics for $5 a month. We just recorded a breakdown on FX's ambitious, complicated book adaptation Shogun, and there's more on the way. To subscribe to our Patreon, please visit patreon.com/nextpictureshow. That's patreon.com/nextpictureshow.
Hey everyone, producer Genevieve here to let you know that due to a recording problem, our guest's audio this week is of a lower quality than you're accustomed to hearing on this show. We're sorry for the listening inconvenience and hope that you're able to appreciate her great insight despite the less than great audio. Thanks for understanding.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it's shaped our thoughts on a recent release. In case you have forgotten me during my lengthy absence, I'm Tasha Robinson. And now that I'm back, everybody else seems to be gone except for Scott. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Tasha. I vaguely remember you. You're into hot lettuce, right? You like hot lettuce?
I love hot lettuce and I hate tropical malady. And those are the only two things you ever need to remember about me, Scott. With Keith traveling and Genevieve taking a break because other people at her job are traveling, the Next Picture Show studio was looking very empty. So we brought in a repeat guest that we knew was enthused about this week's pairing, AV Club veteran and culture writer at large, Katie Reif. Welcome back, Katie.
Hi, thank you for having me back. I'm very excited to be here.
Katie, what is your stance on hot lettuce? This is what the world needs to know. What Scott means by that is, should there be lettuce in burritos or should they just be squashy, gooey packets of beans and meat?
I'm anti-hot lettuce, if that's what it is. No, I don't like that. I don't like when they put lettuce on the gyro. I don't like when they put lettuce in the burrito. And lettuce is supposed to be cool and crispy. I'm sorry, I'm with Scott.
You're dead to me, Katie.
Dead.
Yes.
I'm hitting the button that boots you off this podcast. That was a very, very shortest guest period ever.
Why don't we have Katie on the show more? I don't understand why.
Well, I'll tell you right now that I strongly suspect that she's going to be more aligned with you than with me on the pairing to come. Scott, do you want to tell us about that pairing? Tell us what brought Katie back to the NPS studio.
Sure. Romanian director Radu Jude, fresh off his Golden Bear win at Berlin for his superb 2021 movie Bad Luck Banging or Loony Porn, is back with yet another dark comedy centering on the act of capturing something on film. Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World spends close to 3 hours watching a hairy production assistant, Angela, driving around Bucharest, running errands on behalf of an Austrian video team planning to shoot a workplace safety video built around and requiring cooperation from an actual victim of a workplace accident. It's a remarkably cynical movie about every aspect of that video, from the creators to the participants to the company behind it to Angela, a foul-mouthed and frustrated young woman devoting far too much of her life to driving between errands, working 16 hours a day to help make all this unworthy nonsense happen. That cynicism, the humor behind it, all that time on the road, and a particularly surprising cameo somewhere in the middle reminded us of the way all those same elements are used in The Player, Robert Altman's dark 1992 comedy starring Tim Robbins as an embattled studio producer trying to fend off the existential threat of a young up-and-comer who might steal his job, and the much more physical threat of a jilted screenwriter who wants to kill him.
So what does a powerless gopher in 2020's Romania have in common with a powerful studio executive in 1990's Hollywood? We're going to dig into that in our latest pairing. Stay tuned.
From director Robert Altman comes a story of Hollywood.
I got a writer in here who's got a pitch I think you ought to hear. I think it's hot.
We open outside San Quentin.
The Graduate, Part 2. And Mrs. Robinson had a stroke.
So she can't talk.
It's gonna be funny?
Yeah, it'll be funny.
Griffin Mill is a hotshot studio executive.
Yes.
Angelica, hi. Griffin Mill.
Oh, hi.
Good to see you.
Malcolm McDowell.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Bert. Good to see you.
He's heard every pitch.
That's exactly right. It's Out of Africa meets Pretty Woman.
He knows all the angles.
We're gonna have to have a little sex in this mystery.
Okay, sure, of course. We'll get it.
Slowly, pushes her panties down to her knees.
And all the players.
We're the stars.
No stars.
No stars?
Bruce Willis.
I want Bruce Willis.
Not Bruce Willis. No Schwarzenegger.
Julia Roberts.
Now, he's about to star.
How did this get here?
They're coming from a writer.
Hello, is David Kane there, please?
This is?
This is Griffin Mill.
Oh, the dead man.
In his most unforgettable story yet.
Stop all the postcards.
Roughly speaking, movies about movie making cover two broad categories. The ones about how Hollywood is a magical place that feeds the dreams of the world, and the ones about how movie making is hell, and Hollywood is a cesspit of sin and depravity, a corrupt capitalistic nightmare, or an altar to failure, where dreams go to be sold out and die. A lot of feature films about filmmaking touch on both categories at once. The sentimental ones about movie magic need some drama to spice up the story. And the cynical ones about artistic compromise or criminal corruption need to at least acknowledge what people are hoping for when they come to Hollywood and what dreams they had before reality crushed them. Still, every now and then, a movie comes along that leaves the starry-eyed wonder of cinema behind in favor of just pointing fingers at the messy sausage-making process and the benighted sausage-makers behind it. Robert Altman's 1992 Hollywood story, The Player, is one of those movies, and it's no surprise that it came from an experienced, embittered screenwriter and a jaded, equally experienced director. Michael Tolkien, who appears in The Player as half of a nerdy, awkward pair of screenwriter brothers begging for a studio contract, wrote the novel The Player after decades of fighting for a Hollywood career and mostly watching his projects come apart. In a 1992 interview with the New York Times, Tolkien says his screenwriting career basically went nowhere until he was 40 years old. It's no wonder that The Player, his first novel, was about a screenwriter so frustrated that he threatened to kill the studio executive who blew off his latest pitch. It's ironic, then, that the book that he wrote to distance himself from Hollywood and to show his exasperation with the studio system wound up being optioned as a movie and was adapted into his biggest hit. Robert Altman didn't seek out The Player himself. His agent brought him the script, and Altman agreed that it fit his sensibilities. But he was one of the only people in Hollywood in the 1990s that could have made the movie the way he made it. Expanding on the method he used in the TV series Tanner 88, mixing actors playing themselves with actors playing fictional characters, he invited more than 60 movie stars to appear in the film as themselves, mostly in background shots, or just speaking a line or two as they navigate parties, public meals, or awards ceremonies, deal with studio honchos and pitchmen, or toil away on set. Their recognizable, surprising presence in scene after scene, the live-action equivalent of all those recognizable tunes in Who Framed Roger Rabbit 4 years earlier, gives the version of Hollywood seen in The Player a particular sense of heightened reality. The stars are a distraction for the audience, a game of who's who that stretches throughout the movie. But they're also a way of setting the stakes. The protagonist, embattled studio vice president Griffin Mill, played by Tim Robbins, has power over all these famous people because of his job. But he's more ephemeral and replaceable than they are, and he knows it. An up-and-coming producer may be about to take his place at the studio, so it's a bad time for Griffin to be distracted by a series of postcards from a jilted screenwriter threatening his life. Stressed by his work situation, he tries to deal with the threat and ends up committing murder, then taking up with his victim's girlfriend, the floaty, agreeable June, even though by spending time with her, he's incriminating himself with a police department that never seems to be much in doubt about his guilt. Tolkien's screenplay for The Player is cynical about Griffin, who represents an entire echelon of studio flacks, self-absorbed and smug at best, and murderous and monstrous at worst. Is equally cynical about his studio, which protects him and helps hide his crime to ward off any risk of bad publicity. His contemporaries aren't any better. His competition for the job, Larry Levy, sees writers as disposable and insists that movies write themselves. And in Tolkien's view, even those writers are schmucks who wave their ideals and aesthetics around only so long as they're convenient. They'll sell out those ideals the second they see a chance to make a buck. There aren't any heroes in this business, he suggests, or anyone worth rooting for. But The Player isn't just a simple-minded sneer at Hollywood. In a BFI interview about the film, Altman says the intended message is about greed and how the Hollywood of his era has been given over to bean counters and hypocrites. He claims that's the reason all those stars were willing to turn up to be in the movie. To help protest greed in Hollywood, the focus on the bottom line over art, the focus on market data instead of storytelling. As he put it in talking about why the film resonated with audiences, quote, "People are tired of and object to people who just take and don't give back. In other words, when their object is just to make money. That's why this film is being received so well." The fact that he believes that suggests he's a little bit immune to the cynicism of his own movie. It seems likely that once word started spreading that Robert Altman, the famed director of MASH, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, The Long Goodbye, and Nashville, was making a Hollywood satire full of famous faces, no one in the field wanted to be thought of as not famous enough to be in it, or not representative enough of Hollywood fame. The stars aren't the only way the player acknowledges Hollywood history. It's full of references to an earlier age of movies. Its lengthy opening one-shot take references Orson Welles' Touch of Evil, which Altman's characters then discuss in a little bit of wink-wink meta-comedy. The studio walls are covered with posters for earlier classics. Griffin's would-be killer threatens him with a Sunset Boulevard reference in a series of movie postcards. And when Griffin tracks down the man he thinks is threatening him, it's at a screening of Vittorio De Sica's Bicycle Thieves. This is a movie not just about movie making, but about the movies that have already been made. And it contrasts a past era of glory with a present era of venal weasels like Griffin, men who literally get away with murder. So maybe in that sense, it isn't entirely cynical about Hollywood after all. It's just cynical about what Hollywood has become and what, in Waltman's view at least, it's given up to get there.
Don't tell me you came here to pitch me a story.
That's exactly what I've come to do. It's a good one, too. It's about a writer, sort of. David Kahane.
David Kahane. Who's David Kahane?
Oh, you met him.
Well, I meet a lot of writers.
But this particular writer that you met was murdered last night in back of the Rialto Theater in Pasadena.
Murdered?
Well, come to think of it, Pasadena's as good a place to die as any.
All right, so where does the player fit into all y'all's canon of Hollywood movies about people making Hollywood movies?
I mean, to me, it's pretty high up there. It's a great film. Is it better than Singing in the Rain? Probably not. I think of another movie like The Bad and the Beautiful. That's quite good. You know, and then there are films that are not necessarily, you know, about that subject per se, but reflect on making movies in one way or another, maybe not necessarily quite directly about studio filmmaking. I like Hail Caesar, if you want to go a little bit further into the future from The Player. But I think The Player is quite good, and it, like Singing in the Rain, if you want to make that comparison, it really becomes sort of a touchstone for a certain moment in American filmmaking and how people were feeling about Hollywood and both artists and audiences. And, you know, obviously The Player is much more cynical about it, but it's very revealing, and it becomes more revealing over time. I mean, I saw this film many times when it came out, you know, in 92, and I hadn't seen it in a while. And it's just fascinating to look at it from the perspective of the way studios are run today and what their priorities are. It almost seems kind of quaint. It's like, oh, they made dramas then? They were like talking about making a drama? That's interesting. So yeah, I think it's still quite a vital film, kind of an exciting film, and one I would rank pretty highly about in comparison to other Hollywood films about Hollywood filmmaking.
Yeah, I think what Scott was saying about it being very emblematic of his era is very much how I feel about it. You know, even within the film itself, I'm sure we'll get into it later, but there's also cameos from stars. And there's one point where there's like an Entertainment Tonight style news anchor who's like, "The greatest stars of today are all here." And then you see a shot of Gary Busey. And it just seems so 1992 to me. And yeah. Like, you know, and in 1992, it was, the film industry was in, I mean, I guess a pretty similar place to where it is today, where, you know, the decade of the 80s and the big blockbusters was starting to collapse and the indie revival had yet to be born, you know, it was sort of in a intermediate place there. And I think about this movie, you know, in the grander scheme of things as sort of an intermediate too, you know, when you think about like classics like Sunset Boulevard, or even 8½. And then you have The Player in the 90s. And then a lot of the examples of movies about filmmaking I can think of from later periods, there's La La Land, of course, but like I think of like Southland Tales or The Canyons, kind of like trashy stuff from the 2000s being the...
This one feels like a lot more reflexive to me in some ways than a lot of the films that we're talking about. I mean, Sunset Boulevard, it openly references. There are a ton of direct references to classic movies in this movie, whether it's, you know, posters on the wall whose taglines like comment on the action, you're sort of, you know, offering these little almost chapter titles to some of the things going on, to the film quotes, to the stars themselves. I think you're right about it just being it capturing like a kind of specific moment. It's simultaneously capturing, you know, the big complaints about Hollywood shallowness and the executives coming and going and having very little to do with the stars and people coming in with terrible ideas and being treated as like the new hotness that is going to like, you know, fix everything that's wrong with this industry by making it just objectively worse. All of these things seem, you know, kind of like universal throughout the history of cinema. But then you have like the specific inflection point where a movie can reference Ghost and yet have Whoopi Goldberg playing a character rather than appearing as herself, as so many of the other actors in this movie do. One of the things that just fascinates me watching it today is seeing some of the actors. Richard Grant comes to mind, you know, who are here as playing characters, or Peter Gallagher. The idea that Peter Gallagher, as an up and coming studio executive, would just kind of like fade into the background and like be a character rather than being just evidently, oh, there's another one of the movie stars in this movie. You know, this was a point where Peter Gallagher was not equal to the likes of a Gary Busey in fame. So it's interesting in that respect.
And Gina Gershon has a very small part in the film. She plays an assistant and she really only has a few lines, which is another interesting example of what you're talking about, Tasha.
She sort of hitches herself to the Larry Levy wagon there. She sees a descendant talent in the, within the studio.
Yeah, she's kind of the All About Eve character in this movie. You can almost feel where she was supposed to have a bigger arc, you know, where her ascension was meant to be like kind of a commentary on the cyclical nature of all of this stuff. And then it feels like it got cut, maybe for time, or maybe because this isn't a movie that's all that interested in women outside of the ways that they can be used. But we'll get into that. Here's the question that I'm just sort of kicking around. Does this movie fall under the umbrella of LA noir? Like, we've talked a lot about LA noir. It doesn't have somebody trying to solve a mystery, a murder mystery. It has somebody trying to evade a murder mystery being solved. But it does have a bunch of the same elements that we've kind of like tugged on in talking about LA noir before, in terms of like the seediness and sunniness combined with each other, the sense of kind of a daylight LA versus a nighttime LA. It's got kind of that like the hard-bitten, cynical, like everybody's on the make kind of feel of a noir. And it uses some of the like the visuals of a noir, particularly when it comes to like voyeurism and peering through windows. But you could probably chalk all of that up to Altman, you know, drawing on film history rather than trying to like emblemize a genre. I don't know. What do y'all think?
There are a couple scenes in the film when, Tasha, you were talking about LA noir that popped into my mind. And first is there's a death scene, and that, you know, that reminded me of something out of an LA noir. And the scene late in the film when they go out to the desert, Palm Springs, and there's a desert hot springs, excuse me, there's so many of those towns. And when they're driving out to the desert and there's this shot of the windmills in the background, that struck me as very like LA noir, very devil in a blue dress.
Yeah. And I think character wise, the Fred Ward character really feels like a throwback to that era. I mean, he's somebody who has a very strong read on what's happening immediately, you know, sort of his job as a kind of a studio fixer type to get Griffin out of this situation. So that for sure. Then I think you're right. The murder scene is very, has that kind of noir quality and that nocturnal LA quality. And I think if you want to really stretch it, a lot of LA noirs are about, you know, municipal corruption. And I think if you want to shift that over to the Hollywood system and talk about the film as exposing some of the uglier elements within Tinseltown, then I think you could probably also sort of chalk that up to noir as well. Though, of course, obviously, I think its chief mode is satire and not really noir.
Yeah, I mean, it's a comedy in a way. It's one of those like fairly straight-faced comedies that's still kind of hilarious. It reminds me a good chunk of Get Shorty, among other movies. There are so many movies that this movie reminds me of. One of the biggest ones being American Psycho. The book that this is based on, the first line of it is something like, "Sure enough, Joel Levinson was having a meeting without me." And the scene in the boardroom where Griffin is kind of waiting for Larry Levy to make an ass of himself and is in the process kind of making an ass of himself just reminded me so much of the business card comparing scene in American Psycho. The novel's sort of like narration and the way this movie is really filtered through the point of view of a man who is powerful and wealthy and kind of on top of his game, but is also like, you know, frightened and lonely and confused and belligerent and eventually a killer. Like, it reminded me a lot of American Psycho. At the same time, you know, you've got scenes like sailing into the breakfast nook, sitting down, ordering something, and then like immediately faffing off without actually consuming the thing you've ordered, which is, you know, straight out of Get Shorty. There are a lot of different resonances here.
Yeah. When you were talking about American Psycho, Griffin ordering, he has certain brands of water that he likes to drink, and he always asks for these very specific, expensive brands of water. That reads very Patrick Bateman also.
Well, and of course, you know, I think there's also that moment where he orders the water and gets, he's upset. So he sends the water back because it's in a wine glass rather than a water glass. It's a very Bateman-esque finickiness. But I think that, you know, the critical difference here is I think Griffin's very identifiable as a human being. I mean, as a very flawed, petty, hot-blooded person, you know, not a psychopath, but somebody who's capable, who proves to be capable of violence and proves to be capable of being quite diabolical and underhanded and gross. But it's a different thing. There's a different levels here between him and Patrick Bateman, I think.
Do you think that him being on the precipice of losing his power, do you think that's important to humanizing him?
I think it is, in a way. We'll get back to that in a second because that sort of feeds into the next question I was going to ask. But I will say, as far as the American Psycho connection goes, the way the reality starts kind of breaking down a little towards the end of this film also feels very American Psycho. The sequence where Griffin's sitting in the Pasadena police station and everybody's laughing and the kind of the images start to blur, the sound starts to blur, and then we're somewhere else. Everything about that starts to seem so unreal that I always expect that sequence to end with him waking up. You know, it feels like a classic, okay, wait, you're dreaming. You're having a nightmare, like based on your anxieties, kind of way of framing things. And I don't think that it's meant to be like a dream, even though we do cut to him like lying down in his office and there's no hint of like how that scene resolved. I think it's meant to be presented as reality, which is weird because it goes to some very strange places.
It just heightens his humiliation in that moment. I don't think there's anything too, I wouldn't read it any more deeply than that. I think it's just, they just kind of catch him in this moment where he's saying something they find ridiculous. And then their response is heightened, I think, in his head. But I don't think it's I don't think Altman is the sort who's going to like push the surreality of that moment too far. I think he just kind of gives it a little bit of an amplification.
Well, it's a very amplified movie in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And there's some weird stuff leading up to that, like particularly with I think it's Lyle Lovett's detective character. This the way he talks, the way he's hanging around the edge of the... He's an absurdist type of character, almost sort of like the cowboy in Mulholland Drive. He's just always kind of there and always... He rends the fabric of reality every time he shows up.
Yeah, he's Lynch. He's very Lynchy, and he's always kind of going after bugs.
In a really aggressive sort of way. As far as the question of humanizing Griffin, I kind of feel like this movie maybe starts with him not being an unsympathetic character. You know, he is a rich, powerful guy who is kind of like standing there with the ability to like make or break various people. And he has a lot of power and seems pretty cavalier and smug about how he uses it. But he's also, you know, kind of facing an existential threat to his job, to his livelihood, to his relationship, to his power. You know, he's in a nice relationship with what seems to be a perfectly nice woman. He is presented as the writer's guy, like the guy who actually stands up for the writers and produces movies where the writing matters, which practically makes him a hero in the economy of this world where, you know, you've got a young, brash up-and-comer saying that movies don't need writers and that scripts write themselves.
I mean, I put the fattest possible asterisk on that as sure. being a champion of writers. I think he may be that relatively, but I think it's pretty plain to me from the start that this is a pretty vapid human being who doesn't really, who's not really adding a whole lot to the culture. One of the fun things that this film gets right to me is the way people who are in movies and familiar with movies talk about classics that they clearly have not seen. You know what I mean? Like The Bicycle Thief, great movie, and the screenwriter calls him out on that. David Kahane kind of comes out and says, yeah, you came in 5 minutes before the end. You don't know what you're talking about. And he does that again. And of course, he gets the completely ridiculous speech at the museum where they're restoring classics and movies are art now more than ever. I mean, that is just dripping with sarcasm from the part of the filmmakers. I mean, it's such a beautiful movie in that respect that it could not have been, it's just the perfect project for the perfect director at the perfect time. I mean, just, you know, you couldn't have put it in the hands of somebody who had a larger bone to pick with Hollywood than Robert Altman, or at a time when you know, he just was maybe at his most frustrated. So it was it's a wonderful pairing of material with the right filmmaker. Not just to say nothing of his sense of style and the overlapping dialogue and the multiple characters and the multiple planes of action. I mean, all of this stuff serves Altman's, you know, style so well.
And the clout, like the clout to ask all of these people to come take bit parts in his film. You know, they all got paid scale. They all donated that scale to a charity. You know, nobody was getting rich. This is the We Are the World of, you know, cynical, hard-bitten Hollywood satire movies. But everybody showed up. I'm very curious what you think about that quote about Altman thinking that everybody showed up to this movie, you know, because they wanted to have a part in like highlighting the greed of the system. Was that it? Or, you know, did people want to work with Altman or, you know, just hear who was going to be in this movie? I really wonder if there was a point where kind of the word of mouth in Hollywood was Altman is making this movie and such are in it. And so are these following people. And therefore, if you don't have a cameo in this movie, are you really Hollywood royalty anymore?
You're nothing in Hollywood if you're not in this movie.
I think it's the second one, Tasha, because I can very much see some actors calling their agents and being like, Julia Roberts is in the player. Why am I in the player? You know, I can very much see some people getting upset when they found out that, you know, that maybe a rival of theirs was in this film and they want to be in the film too, because everybody's going to be in this film to show what a good sense of humor they have.
Fun fact, by the way, from the Michael Togan book, that movie is Dustin Hoffman and Kathleen Turner in those roles. And turning it into Bruce Willis and Julia Roberts, again, it's so of the moment. You know, it's so clearly meant to be whose name would you drop in this period? Like, who is the hot actor that obviously would be the A-lister that you'd want to get for this, like, completely cynical exercise?
Also, yeah, literally every role, too. The pitches are always the same. It's like popular movie X meets popular movie Y. And I'm thinking like Bruce Willis for this role and Julia Roberts for that role. And that's how you pitch it. It's just, you know, they're always the same kind of people. But with regard to the ensemble, I mean, again, perfect director at the perfect time. I mean, you know, Robert Altman had is famous for his ensemble work. I mean, he did a wedding, had what, 24 major characters in it. There are plenty of actors in this movie who have been in previous Altman films. So you already have the kind of the ball rolling on that. And then everything else, I think it becomes like the snowball effect. It was like with Oppenheimer, it's like if you're a male character actor in Hollywood, you gotta feel like a sucker if you're not, if you didn't have a role in Oppenheimer. But in any case, yeah, I think it became this sort of party, and a lot of these scenes were literally parties. I mean, you've got Jack Lemmon playing the piano in the background of a scene, yeah. And it's just like, you know, in the way Altman shoots his movies, it's like he loves to kind of start with a setting and kind of explore that area and get different pieces of conversation. And I think it's a real strength of this movie too, with regard to the references that are rampant in it, is that Altman is okay with people missing some things and not missing some things. I mean, for me, it's kind of a treat to be able to do the Leo and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood thing and sort of point out all the references. But he's not hung up on whether, unlike other films that are full of film references, he's not overly concerned about everybody in the audience getting everything that's referenced. And it's kind of what a pleasure of the movie to kind of make these like little connections or kind of these very subtle winks to past works, to certain, like you mentioned, Tasha, the whole ghost thing where that's mentioned and yet Whoopi Goldberg is in the movie but playing a different character. I mean, it's these kinds of like very small touches, you know, that make the movie fun.
Well, to follow up on that, Scott, I think it's really, I love the way that structurally it's bookended, where the scenes you were talking about, where everyone is pitching and they're like, oh, and we're going to get Julia Roberts for the role, we're going to get Bruce Willis for the role. That's the very beginning of the movie. And then the film within the film is the very end of the movie. And I love that he bookends it that way. And I have to say, when Julia Roberts came on the screen at the end, I chuckled, but I laughed out loud when Bruce Willis showed up.
So good.
I guffawed. It was so funny.
And yeah. Maybe that ending is even funnier because Richard Grant is there just like actively selling out as hard as he can. Like he pushes so hard in that pitch session for like, it has to be cynical. It has to not have a Hollywood ending. You have to promise it won't have a Hollywood ending. And then there he is at the end. And there's like a bitterer version of this movie where he's, you know, out on the street watching his dream being sold out, you know, and he's signed away his rights for some pittance. Instead, he's sitting there in the room saying, "Dad, basically, did you see how the ending played in Poughkeepsie? Like, of course we had to compromise my entire artistic vision in order to make this terrible one-liner at the end happen. Like, this is great. It's going to make me a bunch of money."
I think it could sort of, you know, talking about the structure of the movie too, I think it, you know, him selling out, I think the movie's really saying something about Hollywood endings and happy endings and the way that those are manufactured. Because part of Richard E. Grant's pitch is he keeps saying it has to end sad because that's how it really is. Hollywood endings aren't real. Yeah, it's reality, exactly. But then he ends up just giving in to the Hollywood version of it. And I think it's saying something about manufacturing reality.
Yeah, and what he says is, you know, nobody liked the original ending. That's reality. They love this ending. That's reality.
I love Richard Grant in this movie so much. He's so fun. That line's great. I can listen to his pitch for Habeas Corpus all day long with the whole thing about the Japanese lanterns and his little hand gestures. So brilliant. Did you all ever see the movie The Life of David Gale, the really horrible, like, would-be Oscar winner that ended up getting, like, pushed to the next year because it was like a big turkey? Do you remember this at all?
I remember it, but I did not see the movie.
I mean, it had, like, huge stars in it. It's, like, Kevin Spacey, Kate Winslet, you know, Laura Linney, big-time stars. Anyway, it is basically the end of Habeas Corpus is the end of The Life of David Gale. It's, like, that level of cynical, ridiculous, you know, person getting freed from death row. Spoiler, sorry, for The Life of David Gale, which I think has been completely forgotten. But I thought that was kind of funny that when it came out, it was such a howler. And then that I thought about it in relation to the player and how it completely sells out in the same way. And the other thing it actually reminds me of, my most quoted line throughout the years from the player, beyond the studio logo, of course, movies now more than ever, that's something we say all the time, is no stars, just talent. That's like a perfect line of just like, that's how he started this industry. He didn't have any big movie stars in it. He just, no stars, just talent. And then we're gonna end with this innocent woman getting gassed. It's just a great that's reality. Oh, so good. Well, it's a very funny movie. In La Chimera, Italian director Alice Rohrwacher crafts a beguiling fantasy comedy that recalls Fellini at his most whimsical, pulsating with life while delving into themes of lost love and longing. Set in 1980s Tuscany, the film follows Arthur, a disheveled Englishman portrayed with tremendous depth by Josh O'Connor. Arthur, once an archaeological scholar, now roams the landscape with a gang of eccentric grave robbers uncovering Etruscan antiquities. His lover, Beniamina, has disappeared, leaving behind a tantalizing mystery that haunts Arthur and her mother, Flora, played by Isabella Rossellini. Alongside his motley crew, he navigates a world where the line between past and present blurs. La Chimera is a captivating exploration of love, loss, and the enduring power of storytelling. With a gentle tone and eccentricity that recalls recent films like Petite Maman and Perfect Days, La Chimera evokes a Tuscan locale that feels as out of time as the antiquities that Arthur seeks. Our own Keith Phipps, in a 4-star review at The Reveal, was enchanted by the film's dreamy, aspect ratio shifting mix of 35mm and 16mm, which allows Rohrwacher to build a complete, beguiling world. The film also premiered in competition at Cannes and got coveted slots at both the Telluride and New York film festivals. La Chimera is now playing only in theaters in New York and LA. The film is opening in Chicago this Friday and expanding to select theaters later this month. Visit cinemamadeinitaly.com for more information. That's cinemamadeinitaly.com.
So speaking of all of these cameos, I'm wondering, given how many of them there are and how different the scales are in some of them, how some of them are kind of flattering to the cameo-y and some aren't, what stands out for you in all of this? Like, what do you find more memorable than like just the giant list of people in this film?
Are you talking about like kind of favorite moments or like also people appearing in them as themselves? You're not talking about like, you know, small parts for actors who are actually playing characters.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm talking about people as themselves. I mean, I'll give you an example. The movie within the movie that we see a little clip of with Lily Tomlin, you know, full on noir movie, like standing with her face against a window pane with rain dripping down outside. So it almost looks like she's crying, but not quite. And she's got the cynical, hard bitten look on her face that says, like, no, I'm not crying, but the world is crying for me. And I think it's Robert Carradine behind her, like on the phone. We pull back to the screening room and a conversation's going on there, but on the screen, he says something and she turns around and says something like, are you talking to me? Just like in the most irritated voice imaginable. And it's just this little moment of unreality where you don't know whether this is like a scripted part of the movie, like the scene is carrying on, or it's a tiff between actors, just like an angry little moment on the set that happened that nobody's paying attention to within the reality of the film, obviously. And that just really caught me. So much of the cameo stuff in this movie is about stars living their lives in the real world. Like I love the little moment with John Cusack and Angelica Houston, where Griffin kind of pauses them both to shake hands with them and kind of do a like, who loves you, baby kind of thing. And they both have this sort of plastered on smile that's just kind of the world's biggest, I can't appear to be an asshole in public or it will be on the papers by tonight, but I don't care who you are. like smile, handshake, just keep moving kind of thing going on. And so many of the cameos here are that kind of thing, like stars in public trying to live their lives while being famous. But this is one of the rare, the Lily Tomlin sequence is one of the rare times where we're watching actors in this movie doing their thing, like making their art. And so that one really stands out for me as this moment where we're getting to see Lily Tomlin, you know, not as somebody having brunch or walking down the street, but as somebody like actually in the process of making art. And I just think that that's a particularly interesting moment in the film for me.
Well, it's funny you say that because for me, one that stands out in terms of like dropping the mask is the scene where Burt Reynolds shows up briefly and Larry Levy introduces himself to him. And I forget what he says, but he says, "Oh, I was only working for him at the time. I'm like, please don't hold it against me." And there's a whole universe of backstory there that is never explained. And then, you know, Burt Reynolds is kind of like nods. He goes, "Uh-huh." And then the second he walks away, he goes, "Asshole." Like that's the one that stands out to me.
That's great. Yeah, you hit on something I was going to touch on as well, which is when these operators are in these public spaces that are full of celebrities, there are these backstories that are suggested. I mean, you get it explicit in that scene, but even in the exchange between Griffin and John Cusack and Angelica Houston, who are hot off of The Grifters, right? So we're right in that era. You can sense that there's something, the awkwardness in that exchange is suggestive in its way too, and that it's like, how do they feel about this guy? You know what I mean? And how, you know, these executive types probably have frustrated them, a lot of these people. So when they walk into the room, there are a lot of bad feelings there, but a lot of ugly histories. But how does that end up playing? And then you get another scene, another kind of favorite of mine is when Malcolm McDowell, who's kind of old enough to not give a shit, kind of lets Griffin have it when Griffin tries to do his usual glant handing, and Malcolm McDowell is like, you got something to say, you know, say it to my face, which then leads to another favorite moment where he then sees Annie McDowell and says that he just ran into Malcolm McDowell. And they're not related, but I do like that that one event kind of connects to another. So that's kind of like a small little favorite moment. Another one that I would repeat all of the time. I mean, this movie came out right in the middle of my sort of cinephilic undergraduate college days, and so, you know, seeing Altman at this time when he was starting to get his form back, and then being involved in cinematic arts, which was kind of our film programming unit at the University of Georgia. This is a film that we referenced all of the time, and so it was like, so there was a lot of stuff about Malcolm McDowell and Annie McDowell for sure. And then and of course when Altman made Shortcuts, we would kind of do little. Forget it. I'm not going to go talk. I'm doing old man stuff and talking to my college days. Let's stop there.
I'm going to throw out one more thing about the John Cusack, Angelica Houston moment. And that's, they're not just reacting to him as somebody that they have kind of a hostile relationship with or a history with. They're reacting to him. And this is something that Altman talked about a bunch in that BFI interview, is that sense of like flacks like him come and go a lot faster than the stars do. The youngest stars, the starlets, may only have like a movie or two in them, or they may never get big. But the people that are in this movie are still, for the large part, recognizable. Like stars that we know that had been stars in some cases for decades at that time and are still stars today if they're still with us. Whereas people like Griffin just kind of blow through and often have much shorter careers. And I feel like one of the ways that they're treating him there is like, just kind of the latest in a series of pop-up Kleenexes. Like, they don't need to kowtow to him. They don't need to make friends with him because who knows if he's going to be there tomorrow. And given the action of the movie, even less likely because he's already in the process of being replaced. Which takes me back to the point that I was making about when we start the movie, he's not the worst guy in the world. Like, he's certainly not a warm human like person that we love and sympathize with and want to spend time with. But he's not flagged as a villain. And by the end of the movie, he's like an outright villain. You know, he's become a Machiavellian bastard who like mistreats people deliberately for fun. He's a liar. He's a murderer who gets away with it. He's somebody who responds to blackmail with just a pretty cynical, sure, yep, whatever you want. I will just throw the resources of my studio into paying you off to make sure I continue to get away with murder. And I guess my question is, Does it feel to you guys like the point is that Hollywood, he was corruptible, so Hollywood corrupted him to the worst degree possible? Or is this just who he always was and we're seeing him more clearly? Or is it more about like only the worst sleazebags rise to the top? Like, what exactly is this movie saying about people who end up where he ends up and what that means about Hollywood?
I mean, I'd say that he is who he is from the start. I don't think there's an enormous arc there so much in his character, maybe more in our understanding of who he is as he's revealed to us throughout the movie, what he's capable of. Because I think, to quote Burt Reynolds in this, he's one of a breed, as they say. And to me, it's pretty telling that by the end, he and Larry Levy are peas in a pod, basically. They're on the same page about how movies should get made. And I think they always were. I think they're the same type, even if the reason there was any kind of hostility at all is because Griffin was worried about his job. But in terms of, I don't feel like the kind of things that the level of cynicism and, you know, sort of base commercialism that Larry Levy brings to the table is at all antithetical to the way Griffin approaches his job. I think he just wants to keep his job, and we'll do whatever is necessary. And ultimately, and when it comes to the women in his life, he's temperamentally much more suited, not to his story editor, played by Cynthia Stevenson, but to June Goodman's daughter, played by Greta Scacchi, who's there's a kind of a cool vacancy to her that, fits him like a glove. I think it really, he sort of finds his person.
We'll talk about her in a second, but Katie, I'm curious what you think about Griffin's arc.
I don't think it's saying that Hollywood is uniquely evil. It might be a petri dish that has just the right conditions for someone like him to thrive. But I think that what we're seeing here, honestly, you know, maybe this will lead into more conversation about the women in the film. But like, I kind of saw it as a male thing, that when men feel like their power and status are being threatened, they can, when you back a man into a corner, he can bite, you know, like he gets real desperate and sweaty real quickly. And it really is about his fear of losing his status. So I think there is an element of that. And Hollywood's just the perfect place for something like that to unfold, because people do rise and fall so quickly.
Well, let's talk about June, because June for me is the big problem with this movie. And I've been reading Robert Altman's interviews about this character and realizing that he intended for her to, to be like a non-character, effectively, you know, that it's entirely deliberate, I guess, makes it a little better. But I want to read you something from that BFI interview that I just found very interesting. Effectively, he's talking about how he framed June and like Griffin's discovery of her. You know, the reason that he framed it the way he did, with Griffin watching her and she doesn't know he's there, was because he felt that this man would only be interested in a woman if he created her, effectively, if he had complete control, if he was able to map whatever he wanted to see on her. And she's never really a person. She is a like an image that he shapes for himself. So he says this: I felt we should make her a movie character. I tried to explain it this way to Greta: you're not a real person. You're acting in a movie. You don't have to find out the truth in this woman, because there isn't any truth. She doesn't really exist. You have to find out what it is that becomes intriguing to this guy. And I find it fascinating, you know, that a director would just come out and say to the leading lady in his movie, your character isn't real. She doesn't exist. She doesn't have any internality or personhood. She's just an empty shell for this guy to paint as something that he desires. That's fascinating to me. And yet, even though it was intentional, it's still just a big problem with the story for me. I don't know. How do you all feel about it?
You know, we were talking about the All About Eve moment earlier. It is a common thing in films, and I don't love it. You know, like the woman who basically exists to be a love interest, and that's what she's there for. I think on the note of her not existing, an interesting character detail on that is the first time Griffin goes to her house, to June's house, and he asked her if she watches film. She says, no. And then he's like, well, do you read? And she was like, no. And so in the world of these characters where all they do, you know, it's all about writing scripts and writers and filmmaking, and they're talking about films all the time, she might as well not exist, you know, because she's just not part of that world at all. And yeah, I mean, I wasn't thrilled with this character either, but I acknowledge that it is a stock type, you know, a woman who exists in a film to have something for the man to pursue. And that kind of ties into what I was talking about earlier about the film being about, you know, a man who's afraid of losing his status, because having a woman like that on your arm is a status thing, right?
Yeah, and he does take like just the first opportunity he can to parade her around as an objet d'art for everybody to see, to the point where he engineers his much smarter girlfriend out of town, not so he can go sleep with somebody else in private, but so he can take her to a giant Hollywood affair where she's going to be seen, as she points out, by hundreds of her closest friends.
I like this character because I like her for two reasons. I like her as a contrast to his girlfriend, because she is really the one sympathetic character in the movie. She is a person of a substance.
She is
trying to. Yes. I mean, she's out.
Oh, sorry. I thought you were talking about
June. His actual, like, the one who's out buying the Bonnie, who's out picking up the Tom Wolfe novel and is really, you know, intent on doing her job and trying to do a good job, who isn't the Gina Gershon type who's desperate to get ahead, but is just kind of in the trenches and trying to make movies and seems quite sincere about it. You know, whereas June is like, there is, to me, she is an artificial construct, but in a way that's consistently fascinating and strange. I mean, that, you know, her artwork, which is never completed and never shown and built upon, it's both, you know, mysterious and vapid at the same time, which is kind of what this character is. And her talking about how she doesn't read, but she's interested in what words and phrases, but not complete sentences.
She doesn't care for complete sentences,
right? I mean, I just think there's kind of like, you, there's a way you could have made a character like this who's kind of a blank, who's not compelling in any way, because what's compelling about somebody who is not a person of substance, but there is I think there is embedded in this character a kind of mystery, because it's kind of you're trying to like figure out really who she is, what she's all about, why she was with David Kahane, you know, why she's with Griffin, what she wants, you know, and you never get a good answer because again, you're dealing with kind of a cipher. But to me, there's something kind of compelling about that and unusual and distinctive.
I mean, if there was maybe more of a sense that the movie did care about solving that mystery, or even believed that there was any answer to it, I would feel differently.
You're talking about this intrigue and this mystery, and it's like, to what end? In the end, she doesn't really matter to the film. So, like, what's the point? Like, what's the difference between a cipher and a blank if there's no purpose to it?
Because it's revealing of Griffin's character and who he really is and what he wants and kind of like in where he ends up at the end of the movie. You know, he's not the type of person who is going to end up with, or is he really worthy of someone like Bonnie? But in this fantasy that gets constructed at the end, where he comes home and he's got away with it and she's pregnant, and you know, and there's something, it, you know, so wholly artificial about that, she fits right in, you know. So I think in the grand scheme of the movie, she makes a whole lot of sense.
She makes sense for the narrative, but effectively what you're saying is, you know, this is a movie type, this is a movie flaw, like a very recognized movie flaw, but I don't think it's making fun of this kind of flaw in movies, because it's within the reality level of the movie. And it's just, it's never examined. You know, so many other things about what people expect and settle for it in movies, and how movies are made cynically, are called out here when they happen in the reality level. But here in the reality level, you've got the problem. You know, so much of this movie is about just how shallow and constructed and artificial and audience-tuned 80s movies in particular got. And this has all of the problems of, you know, the 80s movie trophy character, but it isn't interested in, like, analyzing those issues or rectifying them or even calling them out. Like, it's possible to have a character like this who is just there for the man to map his fantasies on, and still imply that there's something there, but you never get any pushback. Like I'm really thinking here of Charlie Kaufman's Anomalisa and how that entire story is about a woman that has things mapped onto her that, you know, she's not in control of and maybe even isn't aware of. But by the end of the movie, like, we don't dig deep into her, but it is at least implied that there's something there. And this movie never does that.
I don't think it's its interest to do so, really. It's just, I don't think, I just think she's part of the overall kind of scheme of the film. I don't think, and I think just her presence in the film and her role in sort of the mechanism of it and the irony of it at the end, that's enough. I think that kind of just fits into what the film is kind of trying to do overall.
Well, as it happens, we're looking at this movie in conjunction with another movie that is centered on a female viewpoint, but also ends by kind of dropping her into the background and losing her point of view. I think that there's a lot that these two movies kind of say to each other about the female viewpoint and the female presence. And there are a bunch of other things that I still want to talk about in The Player that I think are going to come up pretty naturally when we put it up against the other movie in this pairing. Do not expect too much from The End of the World. So for the moment, we're going to take a break and we'll be back with feedback. It's time for feedback, but before we get to it, we want to shout out Film Spotting, the Next Picture Show's mothership podcast, hosted by Adam Kempinar and Josh Larson. As we record this, Adam and Josh have just celebrated the release of Godzilla X Kong. Yes, that's how it's written. The New Empire, with their own Godzilla vs. Kong team-up, comparing the original 1954 Godzilla to the original 1933 King Kong. So I know who I'm rooting for in that face-off. I'm a little more conflicted about their current poll pitting Hitchcock's Rear Window against a Vertigo. What do you two think about that face-off?
Which one, the Vertigo Rear Window or the King Kong
Vertigo
Godzilla?
Rear Window. You're only allowed to pick one or the other in their poll.
That sucks. I would go with Vertigo just because I think there's just I hate this. No, I can't. This is terrible.
Nope,
I just took my kids to see Rear Window at Music Box, it was a wonderful experience, and a film. I think a film that's rich and a movie about movies, as we're talking about today. But Vertigo is just what a mystery box that film is, and so brilliant and colorful and. And
pick one,
you know,
Scott. There's not a third option
Vertigo.
In the poll. That's
Vertigo,
both
I guess.
Of them.
If you're going to put a gun to my head, I'd say Vertigo, but only because I'm kind of snobby.
Definitely putting a gun to your head. Katie, no gun to your head. Vertigo or Rear Window?
Vertigo, just because I feel like, it's got that mystery box aspect. And also, I think psychosexually, Vertigo is such a rich text. Not that Rear Window is it, but I think in that thematic sort of way, I think Vertigo has these depths that people are still exploring, and it's been 70 years. So Vertigo.
Well, we will see what their respondents have to say. You can both go over there and register your vote immediately if you care to try to sway that decision. Otherwise, you can leave it up to the Film Spotting family. As for feedback, here is a long one from a listener who's curious about the Roadhouse remake and what the hell is up with remakes in general. Katie, could you read this one for us?
Okay, Matt writes, I'm a big fan of the original Roadhouse, thanks in no small part to the new cult canon piece Way Back When by Mr. Tobias. Glad that feature is back on the reveal. Now, this is just a guess, but I doubt Roadhouse has had much cachet with average people under 35 years old at this point. So for younger moviegoers, the title alone won't put many butts in seats or fingers on the click button, as opposed to something like Ghostbusters or a new 80s movie. For people who do know the original, the thought of remaking it is ludicrous, and I don't know anyone who wants to watch it. So I assume that when most people hear they remade Roadhouse, the reaction is either, what's Roadhouse, or no, why? There's a lot of question marks and exclamation points there. However, if I heard there's a new movie with Jake Gyllenhaal and he's a bouncer at a sleazy club and it kicks a lot of ass, it's kind of like Roadhouse, I'd say. Sounds cool. Sounds like a pitch from The Player. Why remake Roadhouse? Does calling it Roadhouse help or hinder or have any measurable effect on audience perception? I haven't seen the new version, so it might be great, but But it seems like most non-franchise remakes, like the new Point Break, the new Total Recall, the new Fright Night, are not generally well-received. If someone says, have you seen Point Break? Nobody thinks of the 2015 version. So why keep making them? Do they just spin a wheel of existing titles to remake? I know that Hollywood has always done remakes, but I can understand being the filmmaker in the 70s or 80s and looking back to the 50s, for example, the Thing remake, the Body Snatchers remake, and knowing that with fewer restrictions and new technology, you could really do something bold and distinct. But it doesn't seem that way as much anymore. The Lord of the Rings movies are 20 years old and can't be improved upon. So my question is, remakes, why? You are clearly not in film school. Right now.
I don't know. I mean, I think there's kind of that, obviously there's some mathematics, studio mathematics, that makes sense because it keeps happening. And I think there's a baseline recognition that you can start with a film, or maybe have maybe people want to go back and say, oh, what is Roadhouse? Maybe I should check, see that. I mean, and I think some of these films have stuck around in the culture. I mean, there's a reason why I wrote about Roadhouse to begin with for the new cult canon, because it does have a cult following. I think getting into the specifics, not just of why remakes, but specifically Roadhouse, I would say that in a very rhetorical way, because the original Roadhouse, it's like Casablanca in a way, because it's like it has all of these elements that seem that are almost like magical and irreplicable. Like certain things came together in the writing, in the casting, in the director, that if you take some one piece out, it just doesn't have the same kind of odd resonance to it. And so it's kind of has that, I think the original Roadhouse is kind of a magical film that does not lend itself to a remake at all. And I was surprised to the degree that the current Roadhouse is at least kind of watchable as an action movie, but it does not, have the same feeling as the original, because it can't. The original is just this magical occurrence. Have you all seen the new Roadhouse?
I have not.
I have not, but it does lead me into a thought, which is that I think he's answering his own question in this letter, where he talks about existing upon improving filmmaking techniques in like 70s and 80s remakes. I think that maybe he doesn't think that, current camera technologies and VFX and CGI are improvements, but I think there are a lot of people in Hollywood that do. I think when you look at like kids who are in film school now, they're all really into like, CGI compositing and things like that. And I've heard the new Roadhouse has some CGI fights in it. And so I think that, maybe he doesn't agree with it, but they're using the same logic as in the 70s, 80s, which is that, oh, well, we have better effects now, so we can do this more realistically.
Yeah.
I think there's also maybe a feeling of, we have modern storytelling beats and we have modern pacing. What if we remade this 70s movie, but much faster and without all of the boring parts where the people sit around and talk to each other? What if we remade this 80s action movie, but with way more explosions? Because back in the 80s, they had to actually blow up a house, but now we can, just do it digitally. Like, I think there's a lot of feeling that any movie more than 10 years old was made with olden time techniques, and we can improve on that. But I have a much worse answer, which I actually do think is true and is depressing. And that's the incumbent effect. Poll after poll after poll shows that nobody likes Ted Cruz, but they keep reelecting him anyway. And there's just the incumbent effect, where the person who's already in office and has name recognition gets votes from the people who just aren't decisive, like don't go in with a decision in mind. And I think that, sort of troublesome question at the moment, that's like, there are 8,000 new movies out there hitting every single possible platform. What do I watch today? The answer can be the incumbent, the thing that I recognize in some way, the thing that I have heard of before in some way, and therefore I'm mildly curious about. And I think the studio logic for many, many decades now has been the IP that has some familiarity is more valuable, because that's less marketing that we need to do. But as our collective cultural memory gets shorter and shorter, and you get more and more young people in particular that think any movie that's more than about 10 years old is an olden-timey movie, just the aspect of, I guess I've heard of that before, might be enough to like flip that little mental trigger that makes you choose one thing over another. And I think that's part of the thinking behind it as well, is just, it doesn't matter if you have good feelings about Roadhouse or if you're actively curious about Roadhouse or if you truly wonder whether Jake Gyllenhaal like could possibly live up to Patrick Swayze. That vague itch of, I think I know that thing, or I think I remember that thing from somewhere, is apparently enough of a boon to the studio minds and to marketers that it's one of the big reasons behind remakes. Sorry to be super cynical in this pairing about a couple of super cynical movies about movie making, but that's what I feel. Like, tell me I'm wrong. Tell me the world's a better place and people are smarter.
No, it's not. It's worse. It's very bad.
I will say, if you're listening to this podcast, if you're watching these two movies, if you're thinking about these things, you are probably already a lot more embedded in like actively engaging, thoughtfully engaging with pop culture than most of the people out there. And I think a lot of us in the industry that we're in and just the circles that we move in of people that think a lot about pop culture spend a lot of time trying to understand aspects of pop culture that really just come from, most people don't think much about any of this at all. And it just kind of comes down to like, why are all of these trailers giving away the ending of the movie? Most people want to know what they're getting. And if they're watching the new Roadhouse, they pretty much know what they're getting. And that's a boon to a lot of people that people who think about film a lot have a hard time understanding.
Yeah, Tasha. So this was a big thing in the 80s. I read a book called High Concept. It was a film theory book from the 80s. And it was talking about, I realized I've been using the phrase high concept slightly incorrectly my entire life. Because the way that this author defined it was as a high concept film is one that is designed with marketing in mind first. Like, for example, it's a film you can describe in one sentence. It's a film where you can sell it based on the poster. And that sort of role of the marketer really came to ascendance in the 80s in the era that leads up to The Player. And I think it still is very influential today. You know, like Roadhouse remake, there you go. Three words, done, boom, concept. You know, you put Jake Gyllenhaal on the poster, folding his arms. Boom, done. Like, I think that, yeah, it ties into what Tasha was saying, but, you know, the influence of marketing and the importance placed on the ease of marketing a film might contribute to this as well.
Well, this is all tremendously depressing. We always appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations and when they give us an opportunity to fully exercise our cinematic cynicism. If you feel so inclined, we can feature your response on a future episode. To reach us, leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. That's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In our next episode, we'll bring in Radu Jude's Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World, about a woman whose connection to movie making is a lot less glamorous than Griffin Mills and a lot less likely to involve murder, though she still has plenty of aggression to channel in an equally dispiriting environment. Look for that episode next Tuesday on your podcatcher of choice. For ad-free versions of the podcast and extra content, find us on Patreon at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. Find us at nextpictureshow.net and at Blue Sky at The Next Picture Show if you want to keep track of when new episodes drop. Until next week, if you've got something nasty to say about Malcolm McDowell, say it to his face, will you?